We're indeed honored. The second chore that, and I shouldn't say chore here, I'll get castigated for that slippage, a little Freudian slip there, would be to introduce some of the individuals who stand behind important events in universities. First of all, the representatives of our Board of Trustees are here present, and let me hasten to add, I may overlook one or two, and I hope that they will stand up. First of all, the chairman of our Board of Trustees, Mr. John Brupp. And Carol Lick, a member of our Board of Trustees. And Peter Fletcher, member of our Board of Trustees. Are there any other members of the board present? I don't want to get nailed up here. Let me, for those of you that may not be aware of it, this is a group of publicly elected board members who serve at no salary, an enormous amount of time, and are asked to digest and to react and make major decisions on projects of considerable complexity. And I must say that we're indeed fortunate to have the quality of people that we have at Michigan State University standing behind us, supporting this university. We certainly thank them. Secondly, I would like to introduce the past president, John Hanna, whose name was mentioned here. Dr. Hanna, are you in the audience? I saw you earlier. Did Dr. Hardin make the trip? Well, we wore him out on the concert the other night, so I don't think he made it. And you heard Congressman Bob Carr mentioned. Bob, are you present? Well, Bob has been a very good friend and a strong supporter in the early stages of the congressional work, and you'll hear later on from our current congressman in the same area. Well, let me now then proceed. The next speaker, Dr. Cecil Mackey, the president of Michigan State University, who would like to spend a few minutes discussing MSU and the National Superconducting Cyclotron Laboratory. Dr. Mackey.
Thank you, John. Henry, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure to be a party to the dedication of the National Superconducting Cyclotron Laboratory. We welcome all of you to this ceremony and to the dedication. Henry Blosser is a man of many talents. I think perhaps what I respect most about Henry is his ability to choose the proper time in which to live. Had Hank Blosser chosen any other time, his opportunities would have been severely constrained. Throughout much of history, a man of Henry Blosser's talents, imagination, and creativity, rather than receiving honors and accolades for his work, might have found himself subject to having his laboratory confiscated, his experiments destroyed. He might have found himself scoffed at and ignored, charged and tried, perhaps convicted, subject to the Inquisition, even excommunicated. Instead, we find Henry the product of a congenial environment, substantial funding, support from those who understand little of the details of his work, but who have great faith in him, and a willingness to work hard to make his efforts a success. That's what universities in this society and in this country are all about. That's why organizations such as the National Superconducting Cyclotron Laboratory can, do, and should exist at universities like Michigan State. It is important that those of us here today realize that a person we look on as imaginative and creative in many other times, and perhaps even today in some parts of the world. It might be called eccentric, revolutionary, even heretic. Instead, we call them visionary, great scientists, and we honor them for their work, which is important to all of us. What is equally important is that all of us realize that much of today's heresy may yet become tomorrow's conventional wisdom. And while we dedicate here this weekend on this campus both a performing arts center and a scientific laboratory, we need to be alert to the needs of those who will challenge in the very near future the tenets that we hold dear. There are others coming rapidly behind Henry and those who will perform here and who will work in the laboratory, who will have ideas just as creative, just as imaginary, just as visionary. We will have failed in our task as citizens of a great nation and as those responsible for a great university, unless we maintain the congeniality of the environment for the development of talent, for the expression of genius, for the pushing forward of the frontiers of knowledge. We will similarly have failed if we do not provide the continuing mechanism for the dissemination of that new knowledge for the benefit of all mankind. We are proud to have a facility such as the laboratory. We are equally proud to have a facility such as the Performing Arts Center. We treasure no less our poets than our physicists. We need the philosophers as well as the scientists. We must nurture both. We are pleased to be a part of the honor and the recognition of Henry Blosser and his staff. We will be pleased to see the results of his basic science find its way to the far reaches the civilized world. We don't know what the benefits will be, but we have faith that science of this type is worth the support we give it. We appreciate your coming here tonight to help us in reaffirming this commitment and in recognizing both the benefits of this science and the value of universities like this, which nurture it and make it possible. Henry, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here.
The next two speakers are representatives of a very key part of the way science is practiced and operates in this country. Two representatives of the key fundamental research support systems in the physical sciences. Dr. James Lice, Associate Director of the Office of Energy Research, U.S. Department of Energy, who will discuss the role of DOE in research facility construction. Dr. Lice.
Well, thank you very much. It's certainly a pleasure to participate in this inauguration of the National Superconducting Cyclotron Laboratory. Now, this gathering commemorates a very important milestone in the advancement of accelerator technology and its opening of new avenues for nuclear physics research. Over the three-year period of Department of Energy direct involvement in this project, we at the department have been able to witness closely the excellent pioneering work of the Michigan State University team. Such pioneering work, advancing the technology and the art of accelerator building, has been linked intimately to the history of progress in high energy and nuclear physics since that history began. The cycle of progress depicted in this slide depends on the availability of new technology. In these fields of research, this usually means advances in accelerators, detectors, or computers. The new technology enables new experiments to be performed, that previously had been beyond technological limits. Interpretation of the results of experiments at these newly opened frontiers leads to new knowledge, which either constrains or expands existing theories or theoretical models. This in turn leads to new predictions, which inevitably require the development of more advanced technology to test the predictions. And the cycle goes on and repeats itself. With accelerators, the cycle is repeated many times over the course of their relatively short, approximately 50-year history. This chart shows the energy growth of accelerators and storage rings as a function of time since 1930. Each wiggly line connects dots that represent real accelerators built, or in some cases planned, using a particular type of technology. As the technology of rectifier generators leveled off, electrostatic accelerators and cyclotrons provided more energy. Each technology has been replaced by another over the years. Rather amazingly, the upper limit of this envelope, as you can see, forms a line with an order of magnitude more energy available about every 7 years. What this chart doesn't show is that while the energy of accelerators has increased 7 orders of magnitude in 50 years, their cost per unit energy has decreased by 6 orders of magnitude, so that at only 10 times the equivalent cost, we now get 10 million times more particle energy in accelerated beams. The key to progress in physics has been the ability to use technology development to obtain affordable experimental tools. It is this function that the work leading to the National Superconducting Cyclotron Laboratory has served so well. For heavy ions, which are to be accelerated in the cyclotron here for nuclear physics research, there is a whole new dimension of increased capability involving particle mass and energy per unit mass. These quantities, especially valuable to research in heavy ion nuclear physics, are addressed in this next chart. For such accelerators, the MSU design is at the forefront. It is a landmark showing the way to a new realm of affordable nuclear physics research. The role of the Department of Energy in research facility construction is embedded in the history of growth and the size of accelerator research facilities. The early history of American accelerator technology began long before DOE or AEC existed. For circular accelerators, the history began in the old radiation laboratory shown here at Berkeley with the invention of the cyclotron. The next slide, Ernest Lawrence stands on our right opposite Stan Livingston, who is his graduate student. Lawrence used the Federal Telegraph Company magnet, a white elephant of early radio, to build the 27-inch cyclotron in 1932, and then the 37-inch cyclotron in 1937. Small accelerators have long been associated with university physics departments. They were eventually accommodated even in small physics departments. Nuclear physics became a major discipline in every balanced physics curriculum alongside other specializations. But the nature of nuclear physics is such that its experimental requirements have developed in the direction of requiring bigger and more expensive facilities. The required facilities become larger and larger, eventually too large for one university department. The size then has a dramatic impact on the balance between the department's nuclear physics and its other specializations within physics. The approach taken to deal with such problems was the establishment of national research facilities. The Los Alamos LAMP facility is shown here. Its 1/2 mile long linear accelerator provides protons and produces intense secondary beams for research in the experimental areas in the foreground. Such facilities serve the needs of many universities. They are funded with a separate budget and managed with their own priorities, so as to neither dominate nor be dominated by one university department. They operate in what we call the user mode, with beam time provided without cost to the best research proposal. The choice of experiments is made by the Facility Program Advisory Committee. The high energy and nuclear physics programs of the Department of Energy are characterized by their emphasis on the need for and the needs of such large national research facilities. These facilities serve the primary goal of research advancement, and they also serve the important educational goals of the universities. Though they include significant amounts of support provided directly to educational institutions, the DOE programs have a major role in establishing and maintaining the larger national facilities. This has been the historical character of DOE's role. The largest and most advanced American national accelerator facility is certainly the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory in Batavia, Illinois. The circular synchrotron in the distance is about 4 miles in circumference. Next to it stands the 16, I'm not sure you can see that there, but it's there. Next to it stands the 16-story Central Laboratory Building. Fermilab's three external target experimental areas extend into the foreground. Clearly, something this big would easily swamp the largest imaginable university physics department. But in high energy physics, this is the scale of science at the forefront. In heavy ion nuclear physics, the forefront is now here at MSU, at the National Superconducting Cyclotron Laboratory. This facility is fortunate to be located at an outstanding university. This setting will be quite valuable for its program of research. It is, however, a national facility which will have its own set of priorities in order to establish and maintain a position at the vanguard of heavy ion research. The facility will also happen to be a National Science Foundation facility. This serves as an excellent example that DOE has no monopoly on large national research facilities. There's really no fixed rule designating DOE as the lord of such beasts. On the contrary, it's a firmly established principle that to have a diversity of facility types is itself a quite valuable feature of the program of each agency. Furthermore, the availability of multiple agencies as potential funding sources for facilities or for individual research proposals is itself also valuable in maintaining the health and vitality of the research program. Michigan State University has orchestrated many technological instruments and funding instruments to provide both a model of technology for the future and a national accelerator laboratory from which we expect to see outstanding forefront research. The Department of Energy is proud to have been a part of the construction of this laboratory. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Lice. Our next speaker is Dr. Marcel Barden, who is the director of the Physics Division of the National Science Foundation, who will speak on the importance of national research facilities at universities. Dr. Barden.
Well, I'm very glad to be here today on behalf of the National Science Foundation. I'm not the only one here from the National Science Foundation. You've already met one. But there's another one I'd like to introduce to you. It's not just because he's my new boss. It's not true. But the president has recently appointed a new assistant director for mathematical and physical sciences. That's that piece of NSF that includes physics, chemistry, materials research, mathematical and computer sciences. And just over a week ago, coming from Los Alamos, Ed Knapp was sworn in as this new assistant director. So if you'd be willing to stand up for just a moment, you can admire the talent. In In the letter which we received from Henry Blosser, and some of you know that he is a stickler for detail, in the letter which the speakers received, it was pointed out that we expect to be bright and entertaining. Luckily, we have Alan Bromley speaking at the end of the session, so all is not lost. The previous speaker has shown you quite correctly some very important examples of large national facilities which are required to move forward in our knowledge, in our study of scientific facts. He has shown you facilities which obviously are far too big, far too demanding to possibly be located at universities. The point I would like to make is that there are some others that can be, that are small enough, that are within the scope of what a university can handle. And we have here at Michigan State a very excellent example of how much can be accomplished in building facilities of national importance at a university, and how fruitfully a major research laboratory and a university can interact. It is therefore a great pleasure for me to be here today to join all of you in these dedication ceremonies of this National Superconducting Cyclotron Laboratory. We at NSF are proud of our long association with the nuclear physics program at Michigan State. And as you heard from Henry Blosser, this NSF role dates back to 1961, when construction of the very innovative light ion cyclotron then designed was begun. And that excellent machine provided just the right tool for the Michigan State faculty, for the staff here, for the students, to generate a highly successful and very productive nuclear physics research program that has continued to thrive ever since. An outstanding strength here at Michigan State has been the closely associated Accelerator Research and Development Program under Henry Blosser's creative guidance. As you heard from him, but perhaps with not enough praise for his own accomplishments, in 1973 these studies began to concentrate on the possibility of using a superconducting coil in the main magnet of a cyclotron. There were many problems associated with this, and shaping the magnetic fields and extracting the beams were certainly major ones. The Michigan State submitted a proposal to NSF for a full-scale prototype in 1974, a prototype superconducting magnet. We did not dare explain at that time to the National Science Board, which governs the NSF, that we were going to build this crazy type cyclotron. But a prototype, that's okay. The funding was begun in 1975, and in May 77, feasibility was established with full current operation and magnetic fields accurately in accord with the design. This, by the way, was the very first superconducting magnet for cyclotrons to come into operation anywhere in the world. As you've heard from the previous speakers, this success and excellent progress in general led Michigan State to propose the construction of a two-phase coupled superconducting cyclotron facility for heavy iron research. Now that we found out that such a ridiculous design could work, we could proceed with calling it a cyclotron and try to find the money to fund it. The prototype magnet was to be converted into a 500 million electron volt cyclotron, which was then to inject beams into a larger, scaled up 800 MeV machine. This proposal, as you saw in the slide earlier, had the very unique feature of carrying the written endorsement of nuclear physicists from about 20 Midwestern universities. Some of you may not appreciate what it is to get nuclear physicists from 20 different universities to agree to anything. Many of these supporters are here today. This proposal, as Henry told you, was very highly regarded and received very excellent reviews. But there was one slight problem: money. The limitations of the NSF budget permitted the approval of only the first 500 MeV cyclotron, but with the expectation that the higher energy second phase would be funded at a later date and would be able to proceed. Hope springs eternal, even in budget makers. The first machine was funded starting in 1977 by the NSF, and there were many problems characteristic of a forefront development and a forefront construction project, but these were encountered and they were overcome. And as you know, a beam was recently extracted and was recently, very recently, successfully utilized. Furthermore, it's a great pleasure to note that Phase 2 is being built. It had received the highest priority recommendation from the DOE-NSF Joint Nuclear Science Advisory Committee. And that, by the way, is another very major achievement. You may think that nuclear science is a coherent field where everybody knows what to do and everybody agrees with each other. You just have to come to one of those advisory committee meetings to find out that things aren't like that at all. And yet, they unanimously agreed out of, I think there were 9 very interesting proposals in competition for money at that time. They all agreed that this was by far the very highest priority project. So we look forward to the dedication of a national laboratory with much increased scope in a few years here at Michigan State. Henry says 2, if it'll be 3, it'll be fine. My wife says 6, but we'll see. The evaluation of this project was very strongly influenced by the need for a major new heavy iron facility, but equally important was the excellent performance of Michigan State's accelerator and nuclear physics research groups. But another very important consideration involved the question of locating a major national facility at a university. I believe an important aspect of the federal government's support of basic research includes the need to recognize those projects which can benefit from close contact with the university. Obviously, it's not all projects. Obviously, many of the things we're involved with can't possibly fit in a university without destroying either the project, the university, or both of them. However, when possible, it should be done that way. Why? The educational and intellectual environment to be found in a university can have a profound positive impact on the scientific productivity of a research laboratory. And the converse is also true, with the possibility that close interaction with an important national facility will have a significant positive impact on the education and training of students. In addition to the obvious benefits to the scientists and students of the university where the facility is to be located, the on-campus location offers many advantages to the visiting users, and visiting users are a large part of the research activity of such a facility. Faculty and students from other universities and staffs of other national laboratories. There are the practical needs that a university can handle, such as housing and food for short or longer stays. But most important is the intellectual stimulation provided by a university community. The presence of the university faculty members, of the students, especially the graduate students, in the areas of research of the laboratory as well as in other fields, surely imply an important, fruitful, two-way exchange of ideas. The availability of lectures, seminars, colloquia provide strong intellectual opportunities. All this can be particularly valuable to researchers making extended visits, including, for example, faculty coming to the laboratory on sabbatical leaves. Such an environment must have and surely does have a positive impact on the quality of the basic research enterprise, on the standards it sets for itself, on the goals towards which it strives. And of course, a university can provide generally superb social and cultural amenities. The totality of the university environment must have a significant effect in attracting the best researchers. Turning to another aspect of this question, we note that for more than a decade, there has been a growing awareness that the scientific instrumentation at US universities has not kept pace with that of industrial laboratories. The average age of equipment is now 6 to 10 years, as compared to 3 to 5 years for industrial research activities. Instrumentation is often not available because of needed repairs for large fractions of the time. It is clear that a problem is real and solutions must be found. In a recent study by a National Academy Committee, a number of possible solutions were considered. A very pertinent one is the suggestion that the problem of scientific instrumentation at universities can be alleviated by reliance on centralized research facilities used by a number of institutions in a given geographical region. High energy physics established this tradition much earlier than any other field, but nuclear physics has been moving steadily in the same direction for many years. At the NSF, we think that it is very important that some major facilities be located at universities. In this way, not only faculty, postdocs, and advanced graduate students will have opportunities to work with the most advanced instruments available in their fields, but undergraduates and beginning graduate students will also be able to have a hands-on experience as part of their education and training. It is essential that this work should be carried out with modern, state-of-the-art instruments, and it is at laboratories such as this one that such instruments will be found. Experimental facilities certainly seem to offer an important attraction for bringing the best students in the field. We have found, for example, that when nuclear physics laboratories are located on campus, there are generally about three times as many graduate students per faculty member when